Good afternoon, everybody. If we haven't met, my name is Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
Thank you, Kwame. And not quite sure how to introduce this. For many, many years, I navigate this world through reading, through my intellect, through thinking, through processing. It's just kind of the way God created me, I suppose. And what I'd like to share with you today, something that Danielle has asked me to share, is something that I've been musing on probably for the last couple decades. And it's a way of kind of summarizing a whole bunch of things that I've been thinking about for a very, very long time. And I'd like to start with this movie, City Slickers. An exploration on the midlife crisis of a big city man going out to the rough and tumble ranch to discover himself and to ask a whole bunch of questions of the purpose, of the reason why. Why am I doing what I'm doing? How can I find perhaps a different way, perspective of life? And for those of you who remember this movie, back in the 1790s or so when it was produced, there's a scene that honestly kind of changed my life when I was however many years old I was in 1791. The scene that I can set up is the person who plays Billy Crystal, his character, is riding along with this cowboy named Curly, and they're having a conversation about what is really true and what is really right. And there's this moment where Curly, the cowboy, stops and just looks at him and asks this profound question.
Do you know what the secret of life is?
No, what?
This.
Your finger?
One thing. Just one thing.
That's great, but what's the one thing?
That's what you gotta figure out.
And I remember that to this day, obviously, thinking about, is that really the summation and the philosophy of life? And now, 170 years later, I look good, don't I? Yeah. Asian don't raisin, I have been told. So I think I've kind of summarized it for me. What I'd like to share with you is my offering of reflecting upon a variety of philosophies, theologies, perspectives for however long I've been doing this. And I'm going to summarize it in one statement only, and three things that you need to remember. This is it. This is the whole thing. The summarize, the one thing, that one thing. Every single one of us need these three things. It's this simple. We all need a story by which we live, a community with whom we belong, and a meaningful purpose to which we contribute. Life is summarized in this framework by this one simple scaffolding, these three very simple things. And my proposal is that you will take the rest of your life to figure this out. I certainly know that I have myself. Although I still believe this, no matter where I run into this, it does feel like this is a continual journey to figure out what is the story by which I live, what is the community with whom I belong, and what is the meaningful purpose to which I contribute. I see this reflected in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, for those of you who've taken psychology. Safety, emotional, and intellectual security is a story that we tell ourselves about how we navigate the world. Love and belonging is about how we relate, how we are connected. Esteem, respect, status, and recognition is to figure out what is our value and what do we actually bring to the world. I see this in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Where's the crew from Friday night? That all men and women are created equal and endowed by their creator with these unalienable rights. Among these, which are? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I see this reflected in very pithy sayings that you might see on Instagram. Everyone needs four things in life: something to do, someone to love, someone to believe in, and something to hope for. Nice formulation, fine. I see it in reflective memoirs. Jim Collins, who's the best-selling author of the best-selling business book, Good to Great, has recently published What to Make of a Life, where he explores essentially these exact same things. Who am I? What is the story by which I live? Who am I connected to? I see it reflected in our faith tradition, the summation it into one sort of package deal. This is a picture of Hillel standing on one foot from the ancient Jewish tradition of, hey, Hillel, could you summarize the entire Torah, all the teaching by standing on one foot? The idea is, say it quickly before you lose balance. What is the thing that you can summarize? His formulation might be familiar to you. That which is hateful, do not do. Everything else is commentary. Of course, Jesus flips that around, and it's not the avoidance of something, it is the proactive activity at something. And that is, of course, the summation that we have here. We have also distilled all of the teachings, all of the perspectives, all of the text down to this one thing: love God and love people. Of course, that is exactly what was asked. Can you summarize this up? Rather than memorizing all 613 commandments, rather than memorizing every single story along the way, just give me the summation. And so for me, this journey has brought me here. Story, community, and meaningful purpose, which I believe is the heartbeat of every single one of us. And no matter where I go, no matter how many more books that I read, no matter how many philosophies I consider, it still consistently comes down to this. The disclaimer that I'd like to share with you is this is just an introduction. I'd just like to share with you some perspectives and maybe give you an impression. There's a lot in here just to kind of bolster the case. But I don't expect you to walk away knowing exactly what that means for you. What I expect you to do is to walk away going, maybe I can start thinking about my life, my faith, my discipleship through these three frameworks. And if I could distill it down to this and really address what really is the story by which I am living, what really is the community with whom I belong, where I find my sense of an identity, connection, relationship, and then what is the thing to which I am pouring energy, time, commitment that is valuable and meaningful and purposeful in life? If you could walk away just understanding the value of asking those questions and engaging, I will feel as if we have been successful. Not that you know exactly what it is, but that you will have engaged now with a whole new meta way of thinking about life and about perspective. If we begin with story, of course, story is just the English word from the Greek word mythos. Everybody say mythos, which of course means myth. Now, myth has come into our vernacular as meaning a false story. If it's just a myth, it comes from the phrase, it comes from the idea that some things are true and some things are myths. But that's actually not really true. Everything is a myth. Everything is a story. And you could spend your life studying and exploring these mythologies, these stories, because everybody has them. They come from all over the world. No matter where you look, someone somewhere has a mythology, a story that grounds them in their perspective, in their identity, in their hope, in their community, and they make fantastic movies.
In the beginning, there was only ocean until the mother island emerged. Tefiti. Her heart held the greatest power ever known. It could create life itself. And Tefiti shared it with the world.
This story, of course, from Moana holds those same themes, the idea of life. And then, of course, it goes on to Maui, who takes the heart of Tefiti, and then you have to fight to go. Does this sound familiar at all to you? Do the themes of creation in the beginning was this life-creating force, and when that force was taken away, then you're fighting this evil. But that evil may have just simply been the law. Oh, spoiler alert, I shouldn't probably. Sorry if anybody hasn't seen Moana yet. Of course. Why? Because stories don't exist to tell us what is true necessarily. The idea that the word myth in our modern vernacular misses a huge piece of the puzzle. Because every single one of us, every country in this world, every community lives by a myth, by a story. Because a myth is supposed to do a whole bunch of things, and this is what we're going to get into. It's supposed to explain the unknown. A story, a mythology, preserves the culture that you want to pass down. A myth, a story, provides meaning and identity, your place in this world. A myth gives order and makes sense to the chaos that we live every single day. And a myth, of course, is inherently metaphysical. If you want to describe what is happening physically, you describe the atoms, the physical laws, you use chemistry and physics and science. But that's not how we order our world. We order our world by telling stories, metaphysically. We come above that which is physical, and we tell a story. In the beginning, there was this life-giving force. And that grounds us in who we are and informs how we think about the world and our place within it. Let me give you a couple examples, see if I can flesh this out. Stories come in all sorts of different packages, small and large. Let's start with the very, very small. The pithy little sayings that we use sometimes in business and in life. I love this book, The Loudest Duck, by Laura Liswood. Anybody familiar with the phrase, the loudest duck? Some maybe. So let's just take a, do some examples. You snooze, you... Exactly. Is that statement true? Yeah, see, the reason why you can't answer that question absolutely is because it's a story that's being told about a value, about punctuality, about discipline, about responsibility, about consequences. You snooze, you lose. It's a story. And it has all, depending upon how it's applied, it might evoke within you a sense of moral responsibility, a sense of discipline. The squeaky wheel gets... Yeah. The idea that, gosh, and this could be positive or negative, depending upon the application. It's a story that we tell. Hey, if you just keep going, keep going, keep going, keep talking, keep bugging, then you'll get attention. Or on the negative side, oh my gosh, this person, I just need to attend to them so they'll shut up and stop bothering me. If at first you don't succeed,
try again.
Right, then skydiving is not for you. That's horrible, I'm so sorry. That's really bad, I'm sorry. The early bird
gets
the worm, of course. Another story that we tell ourselves. And this is where the title of the book comes from, The Loudest Duck. Because the early bird gets the worm is the, shall I say, a Western view. A Western Protestant work ethic kind of view of the world. But a different view of the world understands that the loudest duck gets shot. And this is actually a phrase that comes from Eastern cultures that says, don't disrupt the community in the status quo. These are all stories by which we live. They are stories that we tell ourselves, mythologies that actually ply themselves in the real world. But they're not facts, but they guide who we are, how we navigate our culture, our values. Peter Drucker, of course, is famous in his business work to say that culture eats strategy for breakfast. What a wonderful metaphor, but again, another story. If you're running a business or you're part of any organization and you have this really clear strategy, but you do not pay attention to trust, politics, psychological safety, turnover, these kinds of things that are deeply, profoundly important for an organization, forget your strategy because culture will always eat strategy for breakfast. Stories also come through humor and jokes. One of my favorite expressions of how we all live by mythologies. Can I share with you a couple? When Thompson hit 70, he decided to change his lifestyle completely so that he could live longer. He went on a strict diet. He jogged, he swam, and he took sun baths. In just 3 months' time, Thompson lost 30 pounds, reduced his waist by 6 inches and expanded his chest by 5 inches, svelte and tan. He decided to top it all off with a sporty new haircut. Afterward, while stepping out of the barbershop, he was hit by a bus. And as he lay dying, he cried out, God, how could you do this to me? And a voice from the heavens responded, "To tell you the truth, Thompson, I didn't recognize you." I love that story. This is a story about our expectations. It's a theological story. We tell these stories all the time. And we sometimes tell these stories because they help us kind of make a little bit more sense of the theologies that we hold around. An Irishman walks into a Dublin bar, orders 3 pints of Guinness, and drinks them down, taking a sip from one, then a sip from the next until they're gone. He then orders 3 more. The bartender says, "You know, they'd be less likely to go flat if you bought them one at a time." The man says, "Yeah, I know, but I have 2 brothers, one in the States and one in Australia. When we all went our separate ways, we promised each other that we'd all drink this way in memory of the days when we drank together. Each of these is for one of my brothers, and the third is for me." The bartender just touched and says, "What a great custom." The Irishman becomes a regular in bar and always orders the same way. One day he comes in and orders 2 pints. The other regulars notice, and a silence falls over the bar. When he comes to the bar for a second round, the bartender says, "Please accept my condolences, pal." The Irishman says, "Oh no, everyone's fine. I just joined the Mormon church and I had to quit drinking." This story is a story about how we actually don't make sense ever. Do you ever do this in your life where, like, "Well, yeah, I gotta do this," but then you keep, you try to put the pieces of the puzzle together and it just doesn't make sense? Humans are nonsensical. How about a story about marriage? A man is worried that his wife is losing her hearing, so he consults a doctor. The doctor suggests that he try a simple at-home test on her. Stand behind her and ask her a question, first from 20 feet away, next 10 feet, and finally right behind her. So the man goes home and sees his wife in the kitchen facing the stove. He says from the door, "What's for dinner tonight?" No answer. 10 feet behind her, he repeats, "What's for dinner tonight?" Still no answer. Finally, right behind her, he says, "What's for dinner tonight?" And his wife turns around and says, "For the third time, chicken!" We're going to get to this story in a little bit, how we constantly cannot see our own failures, faults. Plank in one's eye, speck in another's. Sound familiar? These stories convey morals, ethics, perspectives. They are hilarious and funny because they're jokes. But they also carry with them a sense of human tragedy, a sense of real, like, I can see myself in there and how I navigate the world. Stories are also incredibly important for community. The Mark Iaconelli retreat that we were all on, that many of us were on, was one of the most fantastic retreats I've been on, and Mark just told story after story, and it was a beautiful experience. And in his book, Between the Listening and the Telling, where he talks extensively about how listening is so critical to these connections and listening to other stories, he says, when we say, "Tell me your story," we're really asking, "Can I relive your experience with you? Can I try and see as you have seen, feel as you have felt, know the world as you have known it?" Stories are ways in which we connect with one another. And when we tell our story and somebody else hears it, we have a new sense of who we are, that our experiences are validated. Story is the fundamental way in which we know our being. We all live by stories in powerful ways. On the negative side, Jeremy Lent, in his most recent book, Eco-Civilization, Making a World That Works for All, begins by criticizing, are you ready for this? Capitalism. And the extensive greed and exploitation that particular economic system has foisted itself upon our world. The extractionism, and of course, the amazing financial disparity that that has also created, where I don't even know what to say anymore. 95% of the world's wealth lives with the top 1%. But rather than just simply saying how bad it is, Jeremy Lent goes to a story of an ancient creature called a Wendigo. A Wendigo is a mythological man-eating monster, a malevolent spirit. It originates from the folklore of indigenous Algonquin-speaking tribes in North America. And it is served as a symbol of greed, gluttony, and the fatal dangers of isolation and selfishness. What is the story? This is a story about a creature that has an insatiable appetite. And when it goes and consumes anything, it actually becomes more insatiable. It feeds upon everything around it. And the more it feeds, the more it wants to feed. Because this creature doesn't feed in order to satiate. This creature feeds because feeding is its identity. And what Jeremy Lent does in his book, brilliantly, is not just simply say how capitalism is doing these things. He begins by appealing to this story. Let me tell you a story about a Wendigo and what it does. And the image and the visceral nature of that creature is something that we can get far more connected to. Story is how we connect and how we understand. Stories are also how we make sense of our own tragedies and joys in life. Do you know somebody, anybody in your life who has horrible, negative, tragic things happen, and yet what do they say in the face of that? We had a friend of ours, many of us who knew this beautiful soul, who would always say, "I am blessed and highly favored." Now, if you knew this woman's story about her divorces, her lost children, the tragedies, the diseases, etc., you would, how in the world are you even saying that right now? And the reason is because when you say, "I am blessed and highly favored," you are telling a story about your circumstance that is contrary to the story that you could tell, which is, "God is against me, everything sucks, this world is chaos, and there's no hope." That is also a story. Is it a true story? This is where stories become true when you start to tell them. Whatever your story is, it actually becomes true in your life. That person that cut you off on the road, what's the first thing that you say? "What an idiot!" Because you know that they're the idiot, don't you? Yes. This is what I have decided. But you don't know what that person has gone through. You don't know what they're rushing to. You don't know. But you have to tell yourself some sort of story for why they behave that way. This is actually connected to this amazing Peanuts cartoon. "Why are you always so anxious to criticize me? I just think I have a knack for seeing other people's faults. What about your own faults? I have a knack for overlooking them." This is what's known as the fundamental attribution error, or correspondence bias, psychological term to describe how we can very, very clearly attribute negative characteristics to other people and their faults. But we attribute external factors to our own. The reason why your kids are acting up is because you must be a horrible parent. The reason why my kids are acting up is because my kids are nuts. Stories are how we navigate this world. We tell stories for every situation, for every circumstance, for every position that we're in, for every theology that we believe, for every relationship that we hold, for every country that we develop. Story is how we make sense. And the more and more we tell those stories, the more and more they become legend.
Legend tells of a legendary warrior whose kung fu skills were the stuff of legend.
Sorry, I just like that clip. It's one of my favorites. Storytelling is about making connections between ourselves and the world around us. It is an ordering and sense-making mechanism that guides our behavior, our responses, our actions, our understanding. In the words of Elie Wiesel, God made man because he loves stories. Story is the deep metaphysical substrate and definition of what it means to be human. Homo sapiens are not just another biological species, bioing through instinct, urges, and needs. The question then is not whether we are living by a mythology or not. The question is, by which myth, by which story are we living? Which story have we chosen to believe? Which narrative governs our life? Take any situation in your life. I guarantee you, you have come up with a story or a narrative that explains what is going on in your life, and you have choices. You could have told yourself the story about how bad things are, or you could have told yourself a story about how hopeful things are. Neither one of them are true, but it is the way in which you order. And what I am suggesting is that we actually get to choose which story by which we live. And therefore, the next question after that is, which story is most reflective of reality and the virtues that make a good life? We all have this choice. Very quickly, that's a story. Next is community, and I'm going to take a dark turn. Because one of the most heartbreaking things about this sense of community and connection is to see how we have done horrible, horrible things to one another. Solitary confinement is perhaps one of the most torturous things humans have done to another person. Because it's complete isolation, no connection. And the reason why it's torturous is because you and I were created for connection and community, to know that we are in relationship with another person. This is also exemplified in some horrific things. I cannot even talk about them. They are so disturbing to me. I was tearing up just putting these slides together, so I will speak very quickly. In the 1940s, a horrific experiment was created due to the disease outbreak. And in order to ensure that children did not contract the disease, they began to isolate the children. And the outcomes of that one act were devastating to these children. They didn't catch the disease. They caught something far worse, a sense of disconnection from other humans. This was replicated by Harry Harlow in his famous rhesus monkey experiment, where monkeys would starve themselves just for the sake of connecting with another. From a sociological and analytical perspective, Robert Putnam's book and his work From Bullying Alone is, of course, one of the paramount works that has explicated the decline of this community in American society. In short, the decline of social capital, exemplified by fewer people joining groups, has detrimental effects on trust and societal efficiency. You know, the fracturing that we have talked about, that we experienced today, it didn't start just recently or, 10 years ago, depending upon when you're counting. It's been going on for a long time. And one of the reasons why social media has become so successful is because it's filling a gap. It has come into a world in which we are more disconnected from one another. We have already declined in our social capital. And I got to tell you, you already know what I think about social media, but the reason why it fits, the reason why it works, is because through that fracturing, these companies have found a way to get you connected. And I've heard multiple people say, in my community, I don't know anybody else that believes what I believe or is connected to me in the same way. I found my people, or who I am is validated. And the reason why this exists, and the reason why that is so successful, and the reason why they are multi-billion dollar companies, is because they have capitalized on our innate need to connect. That we feel connected to another human being. Now, this is mediated connection, which is why I will tell you how I do not like these companies, but nonetheless, the illustration is to simply say, this is who we are. We are people that are designed to connect with one another. And one of the great tragedies of our humanity in this particular day, and has been going on for quite some time, Last week, we talked about how the split has become work life, home life, sex life, church life, politics life, but there's a deeper communal fracturing that has happened, which is the idea that there's this thing called rugged individualism, a term that I would propose called independenceism, which is that I don't even need you, exemplified in the idea that I am a self-made, this whole self-made phraseology, talk about a myth, talk about a story that we tell ourselves. Community, my friends, is not about being a club, group, association, or class. Community is about being, identity, and an existential sense of self-identity is a myth. We are only known through our relationships with one another. Community is the deep physical, metaphysical framework through which we exist. Everybody needs a story by which they live, and a community with whom they belong, and a meaningful purpose to which they contribute. Viktor Frankl, in his amazing book, The Man's Search for Meaning, documents his time at Auschwitz in the concentration camps. And it's one of those, one of the most important books we should be reading together. But in there, he outlines how the people that were in those concentration camps that basically gave up hope, that there was nothing that they could do, were the ones who succumbed most egregiously to the torture and the isolation. But those who found something to ply their energies to, a gentleman who needed a fork, you know what, I'm gonna bring that guy a fork every day. The child that needed a hug, I'm just gonna go do that thing. I'm gonna fold my napkin. I'm gonna make sure that even though I'm in this place, I'm gonna create some sort of purpose or meaning for my life. He writes, everything can be taken away from a man, but the one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given circumstances, to choose one's own way. I refuse to succumb to my circumstances, and I am passionately dedicated to ensuring no matter what situation I am, there is something to which I can give my energies and my passions, my talents, my skills. There is some sort of purpose to which I can attend to. Friedrich Nietzsche's famous quote, "He who has a why to live can bear with almost any how." And this is absolutely commensurate with, ready for this? Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Yes, I worked for a week on pronouncing his name. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's book, Flow, where he writes, a person can make themselves happy or miserable regardless of what is actually happening outside just by changing the contents of consciousness. If I can turn my attention towards something meaningful and purposeful, no matter what the actual circumstances and situation is, that can make me happy. He calls this auto-telic, self-directed aims or goals. Does anybody remember the word telic from our last week? Telos, end, aim, goal, purpose. No matter what situation or circumstance you find yourself in, there is always, always a purpose that you can either create, identify, or give your attention to that can give you meaning and joy and happiness. And this is so innate. Just watch children. Whether it's playing with the ball, running, I'm going to catch you, you can't catch me. What is that? That is auto-telic experiences, creating a purpose out of nothing. Play is an intentional avenue by which we understand this. And when we forget about play, we forget about this. Let's see how high we can build that tower. Do you see how simple that is? Let's see how far I can ride my bike. Let's see how high I can jump. This is so innate to our character and to our humanity, and the world has beat it out of us. But you don't have to let it be that way. you can still find something meaningful and purposeful in everything that you do. So, whether it is disrupting the transportation industry through flying taxis and the Jetsons, whether it's telling jokes or smiling. Do you know, I know people that said, I smile wherever I go. Do you know why? Because it just brings joy to people. Auto-telic experience. I have a meaning and a purpose for that. Whether it's bringing music or mastering an instrument or knitting and giving a gift or fixing the world. It doesn't matter what it is. What matters is that you give your attentions and your energies to something that is meaningful and purposeful. A meaningful purpose is innate to our being. It is the want, desire, drive, design tendency for us to matter in this world, that what we do and how we act has meaning, purpose, and value. Meaningful purpose is the deep metaphysical reason for our existence. So, my friends, we all need a story by which we live, a community with whom we belong, and a meaningful purpose to which we contribute. That, my friends, is the summation of it. What does this mean for us? What does this mean for a faith community, for a church? A profound way to understand the grand narrative of our faith, the story of our faith tradition, is that we are not trying to teach you how to be religious per se. Rather, what we are doing is we are teaching us all how to be truly and fully human. If you think going to church or participating in religious activities is a way to figure out how to, once again, find my spiritual life, something is lost and fragmented there. I would like to declare that Spark, since the very beginning, and the tradition that I read from Genesis all the way through Revelation, is this. What does it mean to be truly and fully human? And with that view, we can understand our faith tradition as a humanistic endeavor. It is the pursuit of wisdom. Not just a system of beliefs, a series of rituals, or a set of traditions. And if it is the pursuit of wisdom, of what it means to truly be fully human, then making Jesus, this makes the Jesus life and story universally relevant to all of humanity. So let me see if I can explain how this would work. How do you normally answer this question in religious circles? Well, so what do you believe? Every single other church that I know of has a belief statement, a statement of beliefs. We believe the Bible is the inerrant word of God. We believe in the second coming. We believe in the resurrection. That we believe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For those of you who are new or visiting, welcome. Spark doesn't have a statement of beliefs. We never have. We never will. Oh, pastor's like, maybe. We do not have a statement of beliefs. Do you know what we have? In the beginning, once upon a time. If somebody asks you, so what do you believe? You can say, you know what? There was this man once. Let me tell you about him. He walked this earth. He taught. He disrupted a lot of, and really angered a lot of religious people. Let me tell you that story. Let me tell you about chaos and how a divine creator transformed that chaos into something ordered using words. Now again, part of our problem is like, is that factual? When we read the story that way, you miss it. It's a mythology, it's a story, it's a way of ordering who we are and informing how we live in this world. So what do you believe? Once upon a time, that is how you answer this question. In the beginning, let me tell you about a man. If somebody ever asks you, what is your church like? And maybe you can say, well, it's got these programs and these really amazing pastors, teachers, it's in the synagogue building, whatever, you can describe that. Or you could describe it like this. Let me tell you about Amy. Amy, oh, she's so freaking passionate in pursuing and helping the least of these through PATH, those who are experiencing homelessness and poverty. Let me tell you about Pamela. She is a phenomenally faithfully dedicated servant to prayer and intercession. She stands in the gap between humanity and the divine. on behalf of both. Let me tell you about Pastor Tom, perhaps the most politically boisterous of us all. But he wants to ensure that the way of Jesus is represented in our socio-political context. Let me tell you about Annie and her profoundly meaningful work with alas, a Spanish word that means wings, translated as helping Latinos dream. And what does she do? She brings the very best of developmental and behavioral psychology to the immigrant and Latin communities. Let me tell you about Patty, this amazing woman who is so welcoming and generous as a follower of Jesus to the LGBTQ community. And many of whom, she opens up her home, and many of whom have been marginalized by religious discrimination and hostilities. Let me tell you about Pastor Tanayashe and Pastor Christian's development of these environments and experiences for our young people to ensure that our emerging adults in our community experience the fullness of this story, community, and purpose in their lives as they have to figure out the tasks of adolescence and puberty. Let me tell you about Pastor Mark and Stacy's faithful representation in their regular, ongoing monthly protests for Black Lives Matter. Let me tell you about Pastor Danielle and her amazing thermostat work. No, I'm just kidding. Pastor Danielle and her constant push and leadership at this church to bring the very best of multi-faith conversations, justice, reconciliation, and peace work crossing bridges. Let me tell you about Pamela and Kwame's work with Surgic, the Spark at Racial Justice Impact Coalition, continuing to advance racial justice in and through the multi-faith community through conversation and relationship. Let me tell you about Funny and Mayara, Nidhi and Justin, Jonathan and Lauren, Darren and Ling, Felicia and Jen, all exemplars of hospitality in their homes and in their small groups, creating space for connection and conversation and learning and growing. What is your church like? Let me tell you about the community of people. Don't talk about the programs. Tell the story about the people. And last, if somebody ever asks you, why are you a part of a church? Well, oftentimes you might, it's a very personal question, and you can say, well, I like the music. I like the people. I love the hospitality table. I love the tacos. Fine. Nothing wrong with that. But if it is true that what we all need is a story, community, and meaningful purpose, why are you a part of this church? I hope you are a part of the church because what you are learning and growing and doing here is applying everything about your humanity to turning chaos into order, to pursuing justice, and to learning and figuring out how we love God and love people better. That is what we are doing. That is why you go. Yes. My friends, we all need a story by which we live, a community with whom we belong, and a meaningful purpose to which we contribute. That, my friends, is the one thing. Of course, grounded in the person and life of Jesus. Colossians says this about Jesus: He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created. Things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, all things have been created through him and for him. One thing, he himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, firstborn from the dead, so that we might come to a first place in everything. For in him, the one thing, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. And through him, God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace through the blood of his cross. Everything in Jesus is about the right story, the right community, and the right purpose. And over these weeks and months to come, we are going to explore even further. What is this story of Jesus? What is this community of the church? And what really is this meaningful purpose and mission that we have all committed ourselves to? That is what we will be doing probably for the rest of Spark. Last year, my young son played T-ball. Needless to say, I was delighted when Dylan wanted to play. Now, on the other team, there was a girl I will call Tracy. Tracy came each week. She was not very good. She had Coke bottle glasses and hearing aids on each ear. She ran in a loping, carefree way with one leg pulling after the other, one arm windmilling wildly in the air. Everyone in the bleachers cheered for her regardless of what team their progeny played for. In all the games I saw, she never hit the ball, not even close. It sat there on the tee, waiting to be hit, and it never was. Sometimes after 10 or 11 swings, Tracy hit the tee. In T-ball, the ball sits on a plastic tee waiting for batters to hit the ball, which happens once every three batters. The ball would fall off the tee and sit on the ground 6 inches in front of home plate. "Run! Run!" yelled Tracy's coach, and Tracy would lope off to first, clutching the bat in both arms, smiling. Someone usually woke up and ran her down with the ball before she reached first, and everyone applauded. The last game of the season, Tracy came up and through some fluke, or simply a nod toward the law of averages, she creamed the ball. She smoked it right up the middle through the legs of 17 players. Kids dodged as it went by or looked absent-mindedly as it rolled unstopped, seemingly gaining in speed, hopping over second base, heading into center field. And once it reached there, there was no one to stop it. Have I told you that there are no outfielders in T-ball? There are for 3 minutes at the beginning of every inning, but then they moved into the infield to get closer to the action, or at least to their friends. Tracy hit the ball and stood at home delighted. "Run!" yelled her coach. "Run!" All the parents, all of us, stood up and screamed, "Run, Tracy, run!" Tracy turned and smiled at us and then, happy to please, galloped off to first. The first base coach waved his arms round and round when Tracy stopped at first. "Keep going, Tracy, keep going, go!" Happy to please, she headed to second. By the time she was halfway to second, 7 members of the opposition had reached the ball and were passing it among themselves. It's a rule in T-ball. Everyone on the defending team has to touch every ball. The ball began to make its long and circuitous route toward home plate, passing from one side of the field to the other. Tracy headed to third. Adults fell out of the bleachers. "Go, Tracy, go!" Tracy reached third and stopped. But the parents were very close to her now, and she got the message. Her coach stood at home plate, calling her as the ball passed over the first baseman's head and landed in the fielding team's empty dugout. "Come on, Tracy, come on, baby, get a home run!" Tracy started for home. And then it happened. During the pandemonium, no one had noticed the 25-year-old geriatric mutt that had lazily settled itself down in front of the bleachers, 5 feet from the third base line. As Tracy rounded third, the dog, awakened by the screaming, sat up and wagged its tail at Tracy as she headed down the line. The tongue hung out, mouth pulled back in an unmistakable canine smile, and Tracy stopped right there, halfway home, 30 feet from a legitimate home run. She looked at the dog. Her coach called, "Come on, Tracy, come on home." He went to his knees behind the plate, pleading, the crowd cheering, "Go, Tracy, go, go, Tracy, go." She looked at all the adults and at her own parents shrieking, and catching it all on video. She looked at the dog. She looked at home. She looked at the dog. Everything went to slow motion. She went for the dog. It was a moment of complete stunned silence, and then perhaps not as loud, but deeper, longer, more heartfelt. We all applauded as Tracy fell to her knees to hug the dog. 2 roads diverged on a third baseline. Tracy went for the dog. You are in a world of competing stories, screaming and yelling at you, competing communities, and competing purposes. We get to choose. Which story are we going to live by? which community will we find our belonging in? And what purposes will we give our attention? For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body, given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, "Drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." All are welcome at this table. Please come as we sing.